Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. Welcome to another episode of the Inclusion First Podcast. Super excited that you're here. Very excited to have this conversation with our guest today. So our guest is someone who is very special to me. He is also very smart and has some really great perspectives on social justice, racial justice, activism. We're going to get into all that in just a moment, but let me just introduce him to you. So William Garnes, he is a geoscientist at one of the world's largest private nonprofit research and development organizations. This is amazing. So my cousin is a geologist. He has both a Bachelor of Science and a Master's of Science in geology. He is one of the only Black geologists that I know. In fact, I'm pretty sure he is the only Black geologist that I know. And so this guy, super smart, super grounded, and we're going to have a really authentic and just humble conversation today. It's going to be really good. So I wanted to bring Will on my show so that he can share some of his perspectives with you and so that we can have really just some real talk about the ideas of activism, anti-racism in 2021. So please join me in welcoming William Garnes to the Inclusion First Podcast. Hi, Will. Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast. Thank you so much for coming and talking with me today.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here. Very excited to have our discussion today.
Yeah. So for all of you who don't know, Will is my cousin, and we're going to have the best conversation ever, because he is very smart and he thinks some pretty deep thoughts. So, I mean, I'm like always blown away when I hear just how amazing he is in processing all of this stuff. So no pressure, Will, but bring it.
Okay. And just before I got to stop you there. That means a lot to me coming from you, because I'm like her baby. I'm the youngest cousin.
You're the babiest of the cousins.
The babiest baby of the cousins. So it just always feels great, like, you know, to hear nice things said about you by people that you have looked up to your entire life. So it's just really an honor, and I'm really, really grateful to be included in this.
Thank you, Will. I appreciate you so much. All right, cool. So we're just going to jump right into this. And I want to ask you kind of like a two-parted question. So what does it mean to you to be an activist in 2021, and do you consider yourself to be one?
Well, I would say being an activist in 2021 would mean, I'll just come out and say it. I think that you have to be someone who's willing to confront white supremacy and acknowledge it both in personal terms and in like in systemic capacities. You know, I think that it means more than just, you know, being like on a personal level, being a nice person, or, you know, I don't, you know, use racial slurs and things like that. I think that being an activist means that you have to be willing to call things out, and you have to be willing and eager to maybe be uncomfortable sometimes in a racial space. And I think that, you know, especially with the protests of 2020 in regards to the George Floyd murder, you had to be willing to get dirty, and you had to maybe even be willing to get hurt. You know, we saw lots of people, all age groups, all ethnicities, all genders, all sexual orientations, really put themselves on the line and go out in cities all over the country and, you know, had their voices heard. So I think that in 2021, being an activist really means, you know, just confronting these issues head on and just, you know, walking with courage and conviction in what you believe in, and really willing to be able to fight in personal terms for the world that we want to create, which is an equitable world where everyone, you know, the humanity of everyone is respected and everyone's agency is respected. So that's kind of my long-winded way of saying what I think a activist in 2021 is. And as regards to whether or not, I would consider myself one, I don't know that I would consider myself an activist. I do take part in activism, and I am involved in my community, but I wouldn't call myself an activist because I wouldn't want to be presumptuous or disrespect people that are have really devoted their lives and their careers and their safety and the safety of their families on a day-to-day basis to activism. So I wouldn't go as far as calling myself an activist, but I certainly support activism and try to engage in activism as I can.
I think that's a really interesting distinction that you're drawing. And so the idea of being an activist and thinking about, you know, all of the people, all of our the ancestors, all of the people who have come before us and done right. this incredible work to push forward our civil liberties as people of color, for sure. And then this idea of taking steps and actions that are activist-like, but there's a distinction that you're putting there. And I think that's very interesting because one of the things that we're trying to do on this podcast is to broaden the definition of what activism is, and let people know that it doesn't have to be these huge grandiose things that you do, but there are things that are accessible to you that you can do every day, and still paying homage to all the incredible people and works that have been done. But how do we start to bring people into these small acts of activism that they can do in their everyday lives to, you know, build up that muscle and you know, continue to fight the good fight that so many have started and continue before us.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that you mention that. Because, you know, not everyone's going to be, you know, Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks, right? You know, but what we have to remember is that there were lots of people in Birmingham, Alabama, which is where they did the bus sit-ins in the 1960s, who were everyday people who just said, you know what, I'm going to boycott this bus, even if it means I have to walk to and from work. You know, I'm going to do this little part. And those are the people that don't ever really get mentioned in the history books and don't get remembered, but they're really the ones who make activism go, right? So you have, you know, the organizers, the Dr. Kings, the Malcolm X's who are, you know, kind of at the head of movements. But then you have the people that are really on the ground doing the work. And those are just ordinary people like me and you who said, you know, hey, you know, this is something I believe in. This is a step that I'm going to take to support this activism movement. So I think it's really important that you brought that up to try to broaden that definition to get people to be more supportive of activism and anti-racism, and let them know that they can do that and that you don't have to be necessarily a historic figure in order to contribute in a large way.
Absolutely. And I've started to use the words activism and anti-racism like synonymously in some contexts, just because I feel like, you know, anti-racism is a form of activism, right? And how do we bring that into our day-to-day? And how do we start to normalize that as just something that we can all do? Now, one thing that you said when you were first starting your kind of definition of activism was this idea of confronting white supremacy, which I love so much that you just went right there. I'm like, yes, let's talk about the terms. Let's say the words. Let's call a thing, right? For people who don't know what white supremacy is, or if they think, oh, that's just someone in the Klan or a skinhead, like, can you help us to understand, like, what is the white supremacy that you're talking about?
Okay, so the white supremacy I am talking about is any system that advantages white people at the expense of people of color. So that could be the way that tax dollars are divvied up to fund schools. That could be where bus routes are routed, what neighborhoods they go through. You know, that can be which neighborhoods get police more. That could be any number of things. And I think that white supremacy is the idea that America was a country that was founded for white people to rule over and for everyone more or less to just get in where they fit in. Everyone else more or less to just get in where they fit in. And I think that that, well, obviously I don't agree with that. And I think that that's essentially just an impossible way to run a society and a country. And that it is to the detriment of our society and our country because we're not really utilizing our human potential in a system that does that. So to me, white supremacy is really something that is deeply ingrained in almost every system in our country. And when you think about it in those terms, it really does start to become clear why some things are the way they are, like why there are areas of concentrated Black poverty, like deeply concentrated Black poverty in basically every city, you know, be they liberal, be they conservative, you know, cities or states, everyone has them. You know, some of the most liberal cities in the country have situations like that. So it's like, why is that? Why is it that our society has created conditions so that, you know, you have entire school districts where, you know, the overwhelming majority of the students are Black and poor, and the schools are underfunded and the teachers are underpaid and under-resourced. You know, well, why is that? Well, that's white supremacy. That's kind of my broad definition of it. I think it's a really insidious thing because it's kind of just the way things are. And so it's easy to not even notice it. But I think that as anti-racists, you have to have that type of stuff on the front of your mind, and you have to be willing to notice it, ask why, and then challenge the power structures that maintain it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the key thing that you said was asking why, looking at things critically and asking why, and not stopping at the first answer or even the fifth answer, because there are these deeply rooted systems, beliefs, thoughts that are influencing so many things. And, you know, we are talking about the Black experience, but this goes to all of the brown experiences, whether you're Asian, whether you're Indian. You can look in any of these groups and see these same systemic, like, disadvantages that you're like, why is it like that? I attended an Asian Pacific Islander town hall as an ally recently through HelloAlice.com. And I was just there to listen, to hear, like, what are the issues that they're experiencing that are the same and that are different than the ones that the Black community are experiencing. And one of the things that they were talking about was the different COVID grants and loans and things that are available to small business owners, like the Black community, lots of, you know, Asian small business owners. And this was specifically in New York City and Chinatown. And what they were saying is that, you know, these forms and the tools that are available to understand the forms and how to submit them aren't in the native language of the people who are trying to fill them out. And so if you aren't fluent in English, if English is not your first language, like, there's automatically a hurdle to even getting access to the support that you need to fill these out. And so guess what? That means that all of these Asian small business owners weren't able to get these loans because they couldn't even fill out the application because no one bothered to think inclusively about how to offer this service to and make it equitably accessible to people who aren't white or don't speak English as their first language, right? And so I was like, wow, that, I mean, I hadn't even thought of that just generally, but it's huge. And it's even, that's just one teeny tiny example that is the difference between staying open and closing your entire business during this pandemic, like even resources being available to you. And so, you know, we're talking about the Black experience specifically, but I just wanted to call out that we're acknowledging that this isn't just us. It's everyone who is not white, right, that is impacted by white supremacy.
For sure.
and this idea
of the pandemic really laid that stuff bare. Oh, sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just going to say the pandemic really, it really like just pulled the veil off of so much of that type of stuff, you know? And I think that it really made it, at least for me, and I think for people that, you know, were thinking about this and noticing this, which I think a lot more people than in the past, especially in 2020, were thinking and noticing these things, that the pandemic really laid bare some of the inequities in our society. And, you know, I think your example is a great example of that, that I hadn't considered. But I mean, that's just one of many. So I'm glad you brought up the way that like the pandemic just exposed so many things that I think were kind of overlooked for many years.
Yes. And, you know, just pairing that with all the racial unrest, like, I mean, that's why we are where we are right now, which I see as a huge opportunity. Yes, we wouldn't have asked to get here through the route that we did. But now that we're here, so much has been peeled back that we can't unsee what we have seen. And a lot of people are seeing it for the first or very recent time and are like, hey, you know what? We have to do something about that, which I'm very grateful to have an upsurge of allies coming to join this work. So, Will, I want to talk to you a bit more about anti-racism specifically. And just from your experience, from what you're doing, from what you're seeing, like, what does it look like to be an anti-racist, like, in practice? Do you have any examples that you can share with us, whether it's you yourself or something that you've seen or someone that you know? Like, let's kind of pick apart, what does this actually look like? I'm out here in the streets, I'm out here at my job, I'm out here wherever, being an anti-racist, thinking, speaking, acting in a way that is helping to interrupt and dismantle racism day to day?
I would say, just to give a personal example in my own life, I'm a geologist, so I'm a scientist. I work for a large contract research company in Columbus, Ohio, called Battelle. Yeah, so I'll just give a little plug for them. the first thing I noticed when I applied for the job was, unfortunately, not surprising to me, but you know, there were very few people of color working in the capacity of scientists and engineers and project and program managers at Battelle. And you know, this is a problem that, as I said, didn't surprise me because, you know, I went to school, so, you know, hardly any of my classmates in college or grad school were people of color. And so I kind of knew what I was getting into when I got to Battelle, or when I entered into this, professional space in general, this job and career choice. So one of the things that myself and some of my other colleagues that are people of color decided to do was try to figure out a way to have Battelle promote have Battelle hire more people of color. I mean, just to put it bluntly, like, you know, I feel like that there are talented Black and brown scientists coming out of colleges every year. Battelle is literally right across the street, from Ohio State, which is like second or third, or I don't know where it is, but it's one of the largest public universities in the country. You know, so tens of thousands of students, they put out, you know, Black people with science and engineering degrees every year, and brown people with science and engineering degrees every year. And, you know, we kind of got together and decided that, looking at the demographics of the city of Columbus, Ohio, it's roughly 30% or so, give or take maybe 5% of the population here are people of color. And so to me, I thought, you know, why can't Battelle look like the city that it's in? You know, so if 30% of the people in Columbus are Black or brown, then why can't 30% of the scientists and engineers at Battelle be Black or brown? And this was something that was brought up to our executive team, actually, at Battelle. And I have to applaud them because they were very receptive and very willing to talk about this. And we actually had town hall meetings, kind of intra-company town hall meetings where we invited everyone to talk about this. And you know, we got the CEO to commit to, you know, hey, this is something that we're really going to try to do. We are going to try to make Battelle look like the community that it's in. And so to me, that is anti-racism, right? So anti-racism is seeing a discrepancy or seeing something that is wrong and actively trying to undo it, all right? So the reason why you don't get as many Black people and brown people in science and engineering, I mean, there's a whole host of reasons, you know, discouragement starting in grade school. And then just historically speaking, the opportunities just weren't there, right? Like, you know, I'm a scientist at a major company. You know, our grandfather would have never in a million years been able to even get through the front door unless he was like pushing a mop or something, right? Like, right. You know, it would have been impossible. So this is in general just a new space for people like us, historically speaking, to even be in. And so I think that the I'm not a racist way of handling this would be to basically just be like, oh, well, we're no longer going to not hire Black people because they're Black. And, you know, that's it, done. You know, problem solved. Well, no, right? You need to go out and try to find qualified Black people, and they're there. Qualified Latino people, and they're there. Qualified Asians, and they're there. And get them interviewed and show them that this is a space where they can work and be appreciated and grow. And so that is something that we are trying to do. Now, this conversation really started going like fall, winter 2019, and we had some programs lined up for the spring and summer of 2020, and it was really going to get going. And then, you know,
the pandemic
came and kind of kneecapped all of that, right? So, yeah. You know, we're still working from home, and so we're going to have to reconvene and get the momentum going on this this initiative that we're trying to start at Battelle. Once things go back to normal or whatever normal is going to look like. But I think that that is a definition of anti-racism, you know, just trying to find areas in our society that are inequitable. And then, you know, purposely trying to make them not inequitable, right? Like, you know, these systems were built up purposely to be dividing factors in our society. So we have to purposely go and break down those barriers. We can't just lower them. We have to go march through them and grab people and pull them across the line with us. So that's a kind of an example of anti-racism in my life, something that hopefully we'll see more progress in 2021, 2022. And it's really a goal of mine to encourage as many people from different walks of life to go into this field that I'm in.
I'm excited to see how that shapes up. I mean, I know you put it out there in the universe before just now, but that I have a whole, like, there's so much that you can do, inspiring young people and creating those access points, and being a champion and advocate inside of your institution and in your organization. And so what I love about what Will shared is that he looked around his environment and he saw something that wasn't right, that wasn't working, that was inequitable, and then got together with some like-minded people and started to figure out how they can make change. Like, why is it like this? This is not okay. Who has the power to change this, to fix this? Let's go engage them in this conversation. So these are like concrete steps. Honestly, if every person listening to this podcast like went to their job and looked to see if they had like racial representation, and if the answer was no, got together with some people and decided to change that, like that would be incredible, right? The world would change very quickly if we just looked at our place of work for something as simple as who is even working here, who's allowed to get in the door. Let alone all the things that happen once you actually get there, where there's lots of opportunities to basically interrupt racism. And one of the things that I like to call out in this is like, okay, so we're thinking about outcomes, right? We can see what is the result of the system that we are in, that we've created. And if there is a racist outcome, which is an outcome that negatively impacts people based on their race, then that's a place where that's a huge clue that white supremacy is functioning there, that racism is happening there, and you can go and interrupt that. You know, whether that's the number of managers who are of color versus white at your organization, whether that is the percentage that people are getting paid and what the difference is, who is getting bonuses, who's getting promoted, who's even getting fired, right? I mean, it's very common for large organizations to disproportionately lay off people of color than white people, right? So your work is a playground for anti-racism and really figuring out how you can make huge differences and huge impacts to this work and to this cause.
And I wanted to mention too that this group of colleagues, this is about maybe about 15 of 10, maybe not that many, maybe it's about 12 of us. And this includes, it's not just like, you know, black and brown folks, right? You know, there are, you know, several white people who are concerned about this. There's Asian Americans who are concerned about this. It kind of skews more towards, it's mostly women. I'm one of about three guys. This isn't something where we're like, you know, we're going to exclude anyone who's white or anyone who's not, you know, black or Latino, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's like, there are people who are concerned about this who don't look like me and who understand the benefits of having an inclusive and equitable working environment, both, you know, on a professional level, we do better work. And then not black and brown people do better work, but just like as a company, we do better work if we have more perspectives from different cultural backgrounds, right? Just because we're working in a large, broad and diverse world. Right. So as a company, we do better work the more diverse we are. And then also it's just a more interesting and enjoyable workplace, I think, mm-hmm. for everybody. And it's more enriching. You learn more and it's just better. So that there are people that recognize that aren't of color and who are very much engaged in this as well. And so I would encourage people who, you know, who aren't of color, I would encourage white people that, you know, you can be a part of this too. You need to be a part of this too. Your perspective is important. Your help is important. So I just wanted to put that out there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And in the big wide world, in the grand scheme of things, we all are diverse. We all have diverse intersections, right? And if it's okay for your company to discriminate against one intersection, one form of uniqueness, what's to say that it's not okay for them to do it for any or all of the other ones too? Whether you're a parent, whether you're single, whether you're LGBTQ, like all this whole thought system of discrimination all comes from the same place. And likewise, the thought system of inclusion and equity all comes from the same place and can be applied to any of the intersections of our identity. And so it's really, you know, it's not okay for anyone to be discriminated against, like just period, the end. And so wherever we see it, we as anti-racists, as activists, as good people have the responsibility to call it out and to interrupt it and to transform it into something better that works for everyone. That's what I believe.
And you know, it to me, it almost comes down to as simple as just like recognizing everybody's humanity and everyone's like agency. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, everyone has just certain rights and certain privileges that are, it's just wrong to infringe upon. And, you know, no matter who you are, and whether or not it's even something that people fully understand, right? Like, you know, this person has the agency over their own body, over their own person to do these things. Right. And as long as it's not infringing on other people, you know, we got to respect that. And we have to recognize their humanity in that situation. So that's kind of how I look at what you were saying there. It's important to recognize everyone as unique and individual and as see their humanity in everyone.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, Will, what would you say is one of the most important things that you've learned while doing this work? You know, you looked around, you saw something that needed to be interrupted and transformed. You got together with people. Like, what has been like a surprising lesson, a surprising learning, something that you will be able to take away and, you know, use as you continue to, you know, to fight this fight?
I think it's kind of a twofold answer there. Number one, I would say not to judge a book by its cover. I think that there are allies and there are people who are thoughtful and of good faith that come from all walks of life and come in unexpected packages, and that you might look at and not immediately think, you know, this is someone who is interested in anti-racism, or this is someone who is interested in building an equitable America. And that really, frankly, came as a surprise to me. One of the guys who I work with in Embrace, that's the name of our kind of initiative, is it's called Embrace. Nice. And he's a white guy, rural Ohio, you know, boot wearing, hunts on weekends, you know, shows me pictures of the fish that he caught, you know, the other day fishing in the pond with his dad, you know, he's a, you know, kind of a good old boy, you know, kind of dude. Right. And he's the kind of guy that I think I would have looked at and been like, he's nice, but I don't know about him, you know. And what I learned is that, you know, this guy is like, nah, man, like, you know, I have a Black Lives Matter sign in front of my house. Like, you know, like my parents live in rural Ohio and they have a Black Lives Matter sign like in front of their farm. And like this is something that I really care about. And, you know, that kind of blew me away. You know, to speak further into that, just kind of this, you know, in, not this summer, but this past summer, 2020, you know, I was able to attend several marches in Columbus and caught some mace for my trouble too, actually. But, you know, half the crowd was white, you know, maybe more, maybe 60%. And, that again was something I would have never expected, you know, and I would say, don't judge a book by its cover. Be willing to give people a chance and to accept that there are going to be people that don't look like you who care about this situation. And, you know, as a Black man, that was something that I kind of never imagined would happen. You know, it just was like, I mean, it still kind of blows me away. It was like shocking to see. And it's been, you know, equally, you know, surprising and shocking in a good way to see that people that, you know, are some of my colleagues that work with me that are white, that are willing to do this kind of work. And so I would say definitely just not judging the book by its cover. And then two, being humble and understanding that, you know, no matter how much you know, and no matter how thoughtful you are, there are things you don't know and there are things you have not thought of. And there are perspectives that you could very well be ignorant about. You just gave a great example of that. I never would have considered the issue of getting loans related to the COVID pandemic out to small business owners and the effect that that might have on people who don't speak English as their first language, or, you know, people who are, you know, just are still learning the language and struggling with navigating some of those documents they need to get that done. You know, I like to think I'm a pretty well thought out guy. I like to think I know a lot. You know, I minored in history and took all the history classes, and I read the history books and I listen to the podcast and watch the documentaries. But that's something I didn't know. That's something I would never speak, you know, would have never thought about until you mentioned that. And so I think being humble, being willing to listen to other people's perspectives, other people's experiences, and I would say just always having an open mind, being willing to learn, and never getting too high on yourself and thinking you know more than you do, because there's so much out there that we don't know.
Yeah, I love this point so, so much because I think it's critical to the anti-racism and really the social justice like learning journey overall. Like there's so much that we don't know, and there's so much assumption and bias that's just built into how people, like how we operate day to day. That's not something we can get around, but we can be open and question and aware that, hey, there's stuff that I might even have wrong information, right? Something that I fundamentally believe is just wrong. Right. And so being able to come into contact with new information and not be defensive, but be critical about it and explore it and understand it and ask questions and see how to integrate it when necessary and when needed into the knowledge base. Because the more we do this work, the more new stuff we're going to come up against, honestly. And regardless of how long you've been fighting the social justice fight, like there's so much to go, we're all going to come up against new stuff. So how do we make sure that we're like, we have the mindset to take it in and to have things challenged in a way that is healthy and that can help us to expand our impact, expand who we're including, expand, you know, the ultimate outcomes. And again, creating that world that you mentioned, well, the world that we want to live in, for sure. So I think such a good point.
Thank you. Yeah.
So speaking about just, this is, we're playing the long game here, not the short game. And as a person of color, you're not just jumping on this train for the first time. We welcome all newbies. We welcome people who are ready to re-engage in this fight. But so many of us people of color, this is, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. And it can be feel disheartening, and it can feel inspiring. It can feel hopeful and hopeless. It ranges every single facet of emotion. Yeah. And so my question for you is, Will, how do you stay inspired? Like, what keeps you moving forward when, you know, another Black person is killed or something terrible happens? You're just like, why? Like, what keeps you moving forward? How do you stay inspired?
Well, you know, like anyone else, that's, it's always, it has a large psychological, emotional toll every time you see another one of these tragedies. What keeps me inspired is actually really easy. Legacy of my ancestors. Okay. You know, I kind of look at my existence as just like a miracle that probably really shouldn't even have happened. Right. You know, so, you know, if you want to go, going back from, you know, the Middle Passage, people, you know, getting taken from their homes, getting marched to the sea, to the coast of West Africa, chained up, put on ships, packed in like sardines, you know, took, you know, weeks, if not months, I believe, to get across the Atlantic Ocean, you know, and then kind of getting taken off of a boat and, you know, basically, I mean, it was, you know, just almost like walking into hell, right? You know, it's like, you know, I had a life, I had, you know, a community, I you know, maybe they had a family and friends and, you know, goals and dreams and responsibilities. And now all of a sudden, you know, I've gone through this horrific traumatic experience, and then I get here and the trauma just keeps going, right? And those people, a lot of those people decided that they would rather die than go through that, right? You know, so they jumped off the ship, or they refused to eat, or they committed suicide in as a form of resistance to their bondage. And someone in our ancestral background, for whatever reason, for whatever crazy reason, said, nah, I'm going to keep hope alive, and I'm not going to do that. And I'm going to find happiness. I'm going to find some kind of joy and something to look forward to and something to live for. And I'm just going to keep on living. Right. And I'm going to have children, and I'm going to raise families. And that happened for hundreds of years for people that were in utterly hopeless situations. And yet they still clung on to that dream, that hope. And so knowing that that is what I come from, what we come from, lets me know that if that person, that man, that woman, you know, decided to keep on going, that I have no choice but to keep on going, because we stand on the shoulders of giants, truly. And that really, when I get down and I start, man, this is, God, you know, another person, you know, another shooting, God, you know, like another guy gets off for killing a black man, you know, or man, you know, the young lady in Louisville gets killed and it's like they try to act like it's okay. And man, this is so frustrating. I got to check myself. We have to check ourselves and be like, nah, I can't get hopeless. I can't give up, you know, because I come from a long line of not giving up. And, you know, the least I can do is keep on not giving up every day and keep on fighting the good fight. And so that to me is what keeps me always inspired in terms of just everything. But, you know, specifically in terms of the racial situation in the United States. When I think about it in those terms, it's I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's just not as hard to maintain hope when you know, like that, you know, hope is what got us here. So, yeah.
That was an incredibly powerful story that you told, an incredibly powerful answer that you gave. Amazing. And what I was thinking about, what resonated with me, like you come from a long line, we come from a long line of not giving up, right? Not giving up. And even thinking more recently, I've been learning more about our grandfather, Dr. Thomas Sawyer, and how he was an activist in Pennsylvania, how he organized Martin Luther King marches in the 60s and just like the power of that. I found that out after I started doing this work and I was like, I am channeling my ancestors as I carry on this legacy of not giving up and fighting for equality and equity and, you know, hope and happiness for all. And it's mind blowing and a huge responsibility, but I mean, you just told us all why we can't give up, because what we're dealing with here is such, it's not even a grain of sand compared to what came before and what real struggle and hardship looks like. So we're happy to take this torch and carry it forward.
Absolutely.
Privilege.
Yeah. So I would say privilege to carry that forward and to come from that, you know, that kind of a legacy. So yeah, it's no choice but to, you know, keep moving forward and never go backwards.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Last question, Will. So for the people who are listening, who are currently standing on the sideline, maybe straddling the sideline, wanting to help, feeling called to help, but are not sure how to take that step, how to jump in, how to start to figure out how they can make their unique difference. What advice do you give to them to help them get over that hurdle to come and join us on this side?
I would say first and foremost, thank you for having, for even considering and for, you know, for caring enough to think about it and caring enough to, you know, put some of your time and energy and thought into anti-racism and creating a more equitable America, number one. Number two, I would say not only be willing to be uncomfortable, but almost embrace being uncomfortable. Because in order to get good change, in order to get positive change, it requires some discomfort, right? Be encouraged that, you know, that there are people who are like-minded, who want your help and who want to help you and who want you to be involved. And even if it's in a small way, anything you can do can make a big difference. Because again, to circle back what we talked about at the beginning of our talk here, you know, it's the everyday ordinary people who do seemingly small anti-racist things that change the world, right? You know, it's the leaders that they get written about in the books and get the, you know, the interviews on CNN and, you know, in the news and stuff. But it's the person, you know, carrying a sign, a Black Lives Matter sign, you know, in Brooklyn, New York, who's willing to get smacked in the head by a cop, you know, who's going to drive change. So I would say be encouraged that there's a large community, embrace, you know, the difficult conversations and maybe the uncomfortable situations that you might get put in, and just come with a heart of humility and act in good faith. And I think that you'll find that people will want to work with you and will want to help you. And that even if you don't do everything perfectly, people will be willing to give you a little bit of grace if you maybe say the wrong thing or approach a question in the wrong way. If your heart's in the right place and you're acting in good faith, I think people that really care about this work will look at that as more of a teachable moment as opposed to a opportunity to scold or, you know, cancel or anything like that. That would be my advice. Jump in and in any small way that you can help, it will make a huge difference.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for this. This was an incredible conversation. I really appreciate you for sharing all of your insights, all of your big brain with us. I knew it was going to be deep, and you did not disappoint at all. This was incredible. So, Will, if people want to know more about your work, know more about you, your thoughts, is there a place where they can follow you, find you, learn more about you?
Sure. And then I'm also on Facebook at William Garnes. I have an Instagram. It is Will, W-I-L-L, underscore P, underscore O, underscore W, underscore E, underscore R. So Will Power.
That's awesome. Will, you're amazing. I appreciate you so much for this. Thank you so much for being here today.
This was a great honor. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast. We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to the inclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.